Hello, everybody. Hello. Hello, everybody. I just want to ask folks if they could squish in towards the center of their rows, because there are a lot of people who want to get in. And or if you have a seat next, you can't hear me. If you have a, oh, there. Thank you. If you have a seat next to you that's open, please raise your hand and then we can fit people in.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for asking. She's doing extreme as well as could possibly be.
That was a good trial run. You have to really talk into the mics.
She's got two young girls that she's raising by herself. So, yeah. I will see how this goes. Yeah, she, her husband died while she was pregnant with their second. Yeah. Yeah, she's back. She's on CNN now. So, anyway, good to see you. Dan says hi. Dan Duva says hi.
Hello, everybody. Good afternoon. We're about to start. Now, can you hear me? Yes? The audio guy is on us, on it. Okay, everybody, I just want to start this off with a quick pitch. So I'm Betsy Hand. I'm the community chair for the Conference on World Affairs, and so proud to be that. I mean, I'm just so proud of the conference and the people that put this on. Thank you, speakers, and thank you, panelists, right now. This is so fun. I've been a fan of CWA ever since my daughter went to school here. I came to CWA and saw Roger Ebert do one of his Interruptus, and I thought, wow, what a place to live or to visit. And then we finally moved here, and 13 years ago, and ever since, and you can't hear. God. Okay, here we go. I'll do it this way. So when we moved here 13 years ago, I immediately, April was CWA week, and I just put on my sneakers and my backpack and came over and spent the whole week here, just lapping it all up. So finally I had to, kind of put back into the conference and became financial contributor and a houser. And I just want to let you know that even though the conference is free, it isn't free to produce. And we need your help to keep it free and open to the public forever and ever. So at the end of this session, producers will have envelopes, and we hope that you will help CWA thrive by making generous gifts to us. Okay, go for it.
So with that introduction, for the record, let me say that today is Tuesday, April 11th. It's 12:30, and we are meeting in UMC, room 235. This is panel number 2455, and it's entitled The Siberian Candidate, Russia, and the 2016 Election. And I'd like to thank our producers for this panel, Jan Demarest and Soren Fuchs. Would you identify yourselves? We've disappeared too. They're important people. They're important because they wrangled us to get to the room, and they will take care of any difficulties that might arise in the course of this session. And they also will have the white note cards on which you can submit questions for the speakers if you're not using the CWA app on your smartphone. My name is Joel Edelstein. I am a KGNU News Director Emeritus. I'm also a University of Colorado at Denver Professor of Political Science Emeritus, and I'm still trying to keep ticking. Our topic is the subject of investigations by the FBI and the United States Senate. The House tried to mount an investigation of Russia and the 2016 election, but apparently we're not up to the task. It is not inconceivable that Russia and the 2016 election might turn out to become part of the reason that our 45th president doesn't complete his term. So we're very fortunate to have with us speakers who bring a diversity of experience and diversity of viewpoints to this subject. We are going to begin with Jim Cirincione. He is president. Joe. Wow. Didn't take me 2 minutes in to make a fluff like that. And I know Joe's work very well. Joe Cirincione is president of Plowshares Fund. He has worked on nuclear weapons policy in several capacities in Washington for 35 years. And a highlight of his life was being in this room around 8 years ago when Rachel Maddow broadcast live on Air America. And coming up next will be Guy Benson. He is the political editor of townhall.com. He is a Fox News contributor and co-author of the book, The End of Discussion. And Guy was born in Saudi Arabia. Not too many Americans can say that. And we conclude the lineup with Bill Marmon. Bill is currently managing editor of the online journal of the European Institute. Before that, he had careers in journalism and law. And Bill, back in 1971, made his first trip to Russia, and he made that journey with a woman, not his wife. She was his girlfriend, and she is his wife, and I think she's in the room now. You know, we have the CWA app, and let me read the what we're supposed to say at the beginning of each panel where the app is being used. In this CWA session, we will utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select this session. In the schedule, tap Live Q&A, and then insert your question. You may also raise your hand at any time to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers, and then give your question to the producer. And please, students do get preference, so if you are a student, please begin your question with a catchy phrase like question from a student. Well, the speakers have agreed that Joe would speak Latin. No, I'm sorry, I've got this wrong. They agreed that I think that Bill will speak last, Guy will be before him, and that Joe will lead off the discussion.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I wasn't in the room when they made this decision, which is why I'm first. Let me just say it's a real pleasure to be back at CWA. I missed last year's conference. I've been coming, I forget how long I've been coming, but I think I first came here in 2004. And it's a real treat to be here. And I put my work aside. I had to do a few emails, few conference calls, but I put my work aside just to soak up all the amazing intellectual resources you folks gather in this one geographic spot for a week every year. And we're going to be tested to use those intellectual resources to see if there's anything new we can say on this topic. I mean, we have been talking about this. It feels like nonstop. We have a section here called Ebert Interruptus. It feels like Russia Interruptus. We talk about this and something happens and we get off Russia for a few days, and then we talk about Russia again, and then something happens and we... This is not going away. This is going to be with us for some time to come. Months through next November's by-election, certainly. And I think the reason for that is that it's real. That the evidence that Russia intentionally manipulated, intervened in the U.S. election in order to help elect Donald Trump, to favor one candidate or the other, is really overwhelming. I know we're going to discuss this, but it takes a lot of evidence for the U.S. intelligence agencies to come to such a conclusion, and that is the conclusion that they came to. It doesn't mean we should all accept that. I'm just saying the preponderance of evidence indicates that this is what in fact happened. And one of the reasons we think that is because it continues to happen in other countries. They're trying to do this in France right now. In France, it's even a little more blatant. And this is why this is part of an international phenomenon. It's not just Donald Trump they favor. It's the candidates of this economic nationalism, or you might think of it as white nationalist movements. To say that it's populist is misleading, but let's say popular white nationalist movements that are throughout Europe, why the Russians are intervening to do this, establishing something unlike anything we've seen since the Soviet Union had a network of friendly communist parties throughout Western Europe. In the last couple of weeks, Marine Le Pen, one of the candidates for the presidency, goes to Moscow and meets with Putin. Now, I'm old enough to remember when something like that would be disqualifying for a candidate, to be seen in that way, to be seen as actively courting the support of a leader of an adversarial nation. But here it's seen as an asset. And we know that this is the Russian strategy, to sow this kind of discord. Why? Because they feel besieged. Remember, Russia is in a weak geopolitical position. This is a country with the economy the size of Spain's. They spend a fortune on military, but they're still way behind what we spend on the military. Their equipment, their military isn't very good for much except intervening at their borders. Mainly, they're involved in border issues. They don't have a projection capability. They see themselves surrounded by adversaries. As far as I can see, they only have two allies in the world, Belarus and Syria. That's pretty much it. And Putin personally blames the Western countries, in particular the United States, for trying to destabilize Russia. He blames us for the so-called colored revolutions that took place all over Western Europe after the collapse of the Soviet Empire, and Hillary Clinton in particular. So we had a particular grudge against Hillary Clinton, and this was payback. This was payback on that. He believes that she, I don't think this is true, by the way, but he believes that she was responsible for and encouraged and maybe even funded and maybe even manipulated the demonstrations against him after his recent presidential election. And so now he's coming back. And he's been doing this through all the means that you're now well aware, these fake news sites. In fact, this disinformation campaign that's churned up. Just today, the U.S. intelligence agencies released a 4-page declassified assessment of why they believe Russia was complicit with Syria on the chemical weapons attack. And the last thing they say in there is what's going on now. Maybe you've been in some of the discussions that we've had where people are saying, no, the Russians didn't do this. This was rebel chemical weapons. Or there was no attack on this site at all. Or it wasn't sarin. And that's because there's all these other contrary stories out there. And the situation is a little unclear. This is true. And the last thing the intelligence agency says is this is consistent with Russian activities. They sow confusion by spreading multiple stories, multiple possibility, multiple interpretation of the events we're seeing ourselves. And that's what they did in this election. The real tragedy is what's happening in the Congress, that they will not do a serious investigation of this. Maybe there's some hope with the Senate Intelligence Committee. That looks promising. But the debacle at the House Intelligence Committee is a national embarrassment. It's a national embarrassment. Look, I used to work on an investigative agency for Congress. I worked on the Government Operations Committee. We were the Congress. This was, Clinton was president. Fine, Clinton's president. We're the freaking Congress. We have oversight over you. We investigate executive branch activities. We don't collude with you. We don't cooperate with you. And this absurd kabuki theater of having the Republican head of the House Intelligence Committee trot over to the White House to get information, rush back to the Capitol, do a press conference, and then rush back the next day to tell the White House what they already knew was absurd. But it sows confusion. It sows confusion. It feeds into the base that Donald Trump relies on for his support, that sees everything else going on out there as a conspiracy. There's a huge conspiracy against me, Donald Trump. There's a huge conspiracy against you, the white working and middle classes of the country. And it feeds into that view. You're getting screwed, and I'm the only one who can defend you. And now they're attacking me because I'm trying to help you. There is an upside to this. Well, there's two. And let me go to the first policy upside. And then I'll close. I spent my life working on nuclear policy. I believe we should reduce and eliminate nuclear weapons. I run an organization dedicated to that, just to get rid of it. I believe what Ronald Reagan believed, that we should banish nuclear weapons from the face of the earth. Donald Trump can help do that. Republicans, it turns out, are much better at cutting nuclear weapons than Democrats. Republicans do sweeping deals with our adversaries to cut nuclear weapons. Ronald Reagan cut the nuclear weapons arsenal of the United States and Russia, Soviet Union then, in half. H.W. Bush cuts it in half. W. Bush cuts it in half. Obama and Clinton sort of trim at the edges. And the reason is simple when you stop to think about it. Republican presidents have much more political space to go do something like this. They have the confidence, not just of the American people, but of their own party. So when you see a rock-solid conservative, or in the case of Donald Trump, something, when you see a person who's got the support of the Republican Party making a deal, you bring the whole party with you and the Democrats support, and it goes to the Senate. That doesn't mean it's easy, but it's easier than when a Democrat does it. And one of the consistent planks in Donald Trump's campaign was, in addition to building a wall and smashing ISIS, was improve relations with Russia. Why shouldn't we improve relations with Russia? Well, if he actually did that, it would almost by definition have a nuclear component to it. So if I was voting my interest, I would have voted for Donald Trump. Because he can make a nuclear deal that, frankly, Hillary Clinton would have had a much harder time making. So there's an upside to this. If Donald Trump can actually improve Russian relations. And here's the other upside, and it's the reaction to the Trump election, which is in part because of the outrageous manipulation of Russia, the involvement of an adversarial nature in our election, and that is the emergence of the biggest mass movement I have ever seen in my life. That has just erupted in full form on January 21st. I've been an organizer my entire life. I've been an organizer since I was 17, organizing psychology students at Boston College for representation in the student government. I have never seen anything like this. And this has the potential to fundamentally change U.S. politics, to fundamentally change how we do U.S. politics. So if there's one upside to the Russian manipulation in this election cycle, it's the reaction of the American people, and it's in full voice right now. And that is one of the most encouraging things I've ever seen in my life. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Joe. Up next, Guy Benson.
All right. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here. This has been exhausting just to try to follow, right? You're trying to follow the plot of this, and it's hard. I do this for a living, following the news every day, and it is a struggle to separate fact from speculation from fiction. And so what I'm going to try to do is lay out what I think are four actual known facts about this entire situation, and then we can talk perhaps in our session beyond our opening statements in Q&A about some of the speculation and where things might go. So I would start with a very important first fact, which is, in my mind, there is no question that the Russian government meddled and interfered in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. This is the consensus view of the entire U.S. intelligence community, from the FBI to the CIA to the NSA. It is also the consensus view across party lines among those who sit on the relevant intelligence committees. You know, even people who would get booed in this room like Devin Nunes concede this point fully. The Russians did this. At least they attempted to do it. There's no question about that. I would also note, we saw this from Director Comey in his testimony not too long ago, that yes, not only was there interference, it was interference with a thumb on the scale. There was a clear preference by the Kremlin for Donald Trump and against Hillary Clinton. Now, there's also indications that the Kremlin believed that Clinton was going to win, as did many people, and they were working in advance to undermine faith in her, what they thought was an inevitable administration. We've also learned over the course of some of these investigations that Russian meddling is not necessarily partisan, despite the fact that I just said about Trump versus Hillary, because the Russian propaganda machine has also targeted some of the more outspoken voices against Russia within the Republican Party, including the Speaker of the House, Senator Marco Rubio, and others. So that's one fact. And it's under investigation from the FBI and from both houses in Congress, the intelligence committees. I actually agree with you on the Senate point. I think that that is, if you're looking for a good congressional investigation, that's the one to pin your hopes on at this point. Fact number two, there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever to support the president's allegation that his predecessor wiretapped his phones. That's an extraordinary claim that requires extraordinary evidence, and there is none. There's no evidence, let alone extraordinary evidence. There are open questions about surveillance of people within Trump's orbit and how they were swept up in incidental collections of wiretaps, how and why their names were unmasked and disseminated around the intelligence community and around Washington, D.C., and frankly, elements of the media as well. Susan Rice got herself into some trouble by saying she knew nothing about it, and then that story's changed a little bit. She knew something about it, but there was nothing improper, she says. And then there's also the big issue of leaks. There are national security factoids. There is sensitive and classified information that has leaked out to the press. That is a crime. The source of those leaks is a legitimate issue. So there are multiple tracks, I think, on this wider saga that merits serious investigation. Fact number three, the Russians did not hack the election in the sense of changing the vote totals of the American people. There are conspiracy theories flying around on the right, some of which are directly started by the President of the United States himself. But also, there was a poll in January from YouGov, which is the polling partner of The Economist, that showed that 52% of Democratic voters in America believe the Russians altered the vote totals. That is a tinfoil hat conspiracy with no basis whatsoever. You know, Hillary Clinton lost Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania all by herself. She chose not to campaign in Wisconsin and Michigan, which is a shocking instance of historic political malpractice. I'd say one small data point on that, which still blows my mind. In the closing weeks of the election, the Clinton campaign ran more ads in the media market of Omaha, Nebraska, trying to make a play for one electoral vote in Nebraska than they did in Michigan and Wisconsin combined. That is not Vladimir Putin doing voodoo from long distance with a Jedi mind trick telling Hillary Clinton to run a totally shockingly inept campaign in the middle, in the Midwest. Although, we could talk about Mrs. Clinton's record in the Middle East. That was on her and her campaign. The American people made their decision. And let's not pretend that the Russia issue was not adjudicated significantly in the election. Hillary Clinton accused Donald Trump of being a puppet of the Russians in a nationally televised debate, which prompted the immortal response from Donald Trump, "No puppet, no puppet, you're the puppet." Which was pretty compelling, I thought. So, that's the third fact. And the final fact is, and this is a crucial one, as of now, we have zero evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. We have heard rumors and speculation that this might be the case. Mr. Schiff from California has said this and then sort of retracted it a few times, which I think added to the, there's a term of art that I want to use, but I won't, but the mess in the House Intelligence Committee, for which there is responsibility, I think, on both sides. As of now, we don't have any of that evidence. I fully support the FBI investigation into this. I fully support the congressional probes into this. It's a serious question, but there's been a lot of leaking. A lot of leaking designed to make, I think, the president look bad and to weaken his presidency. And if they had the goods on collusion, if they had a smoking gun, I think we would have seen it already, New York Times front page. Which is not to say that the evidence does not exist somewhere. It may. I don't know. But we don't know that for a fact. And I want to point out, in closing, CNN, this is sort of, I think, illustrative of the reporting that has fed this narrative that I think isn't very good reporting, to put it mildly. This was a CNN scoop a couple weeks ago that got lots and lots of breathless coverage. Listen to all the weasel words and hedges in this lead. Dateline Washington. The FBI has information that indicates associates of President Donald Trump communicated with suspected Russian operatives to possibly coordinate the release of information damaging to Hillary Clinton's campaign. Which is to say nothing. Which is to say nothing. However, this was treated as a four-alarm story that there was coordination. Again, my mind is open. I don't trust anyone in this. I don't know where this is going to go. I hope we follow the facts and we don't follow political narratives on either side. The left only wants to talk about Russia, 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 and sort of turn a blind eye to a lot of the other factors at play here, including the leaking. And the president and a lot of the Republicans only want to talk about the leaking and Susan Rice. I believe we can walk and chew gum at the same time. Let's look at both of these things because we're adults and these are serious matters involving a hostile power trying to influence our elections. That should be completely unacceptable to every single American, regardless of political affiliation or belief. So that's where I come from on this, and I look forward to our continued discussion. Thanks.
Thank you, Guy. Before we move on, if you have an empty chair next to you, would you please raise your hand so that we can guide people who would need seats to the seats that are available? Are there any?
One.
Okay, there's one right there. Great, thanks very much. And now Bill Marmon.
Good morning or good afternoon, whatever we are here. Can you hear me?
Closer to the mic.
Yeah. How about now? Okay. Well, I'm, I chose to be last, but because I knew that my colleagues here would outline most of the facts of the case here, I want to talk about rumor and speculation and gossip. We were all in Washington, I think. You were in Washington? And in Washington, the air is alive with Russia and not the fact that the Russians interfered with our election. Everybody admits that, as we all agree. But the issue is collusion. Did the Trump campaign collude with Russia? And does somehow Putin have something on Trump that makes him the Siberian candidate? So I think it's a very telling title for this panel. And let me just quote a few of the columnists who've been talking about this issue. Nicholas Kristof had a column in the New York Times recently. The smell of treason is in the air, he says, speculating that the contours of a major American scandal could be forming around the connections between Trump and Russia. And liberals in general have totally abandoned all inhibitions about claiming that Trump is unfit for office. And one of their planks in this assumption is that there is something really rotten in the state of Denmark, or in the state of Moscow, or in the state of Trumpland, Mar-a-Lago. Dana Milbank recently wrote, "My worry is that the president of the United States is barking mad." Another columnist says, "What is the Democratic nation to do when the man serving as president plainly has no business being president of the United States?" And even moderate David Brooks has written, "I still have trouble seeing how the Trump administration survives a full term." Well, here is the liberal fantasy, and it surfaces around what is being whispered in Washington and probably beyond, the 25th Amendment. Now, the 25th Amendment is the amendment that was passed. It's a recent amendment. It was passed to provide for the succession of the presidency. Now, I'm going to tell you about how that works. It works like this. When the vice president and a majority of the principal officers in the executive departments, meaning the cabinet officers, transmit a letter to the president pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker of the House that the president is unfit or unable to discharge his powers, the vice president shall immediately assume the powers and duties and become the acting president. And there you have it. As Jeff Greenfield recently wrote, "The dream burns bright in countless liberal minds and hearts. President Trump embraces one too many fever swamp conspiracy theories, tweets one too many palpable falsehoods, threatens a nuclear attack on Mexico for not paying for the wall, and a terrified cabinet meets in Vice President Mike Pence's home in Naval Observatory and proclaims in a written declaration to the Speaker of the House and the President pro tem of the Senate that the president is unable to discharge his duties." And just like that, President Trump is dispatched to Trump Tower or Mar-a-Lago, and Pence becomes acting president. Well, dream on. And why would you say would that be done by the Republicans, people who presumably have a vested interest in Trump? Well, it's possible that Trump may go too far, may become an embarrassment for his own party, and that the 25th Amendment would be a much more convenient way of getting rid of him and truncating his term, as the moderator suggested is sort of in the cards here, than an impeachment proceeding. Now, there's some problems with this scenario, of course, and that is that when the president who is removed by under the 25th Amendment says in his conscience and says, "No way, Jose," and transmits his own letter to the relevant houses, then he can let me read you the language here. Transmits his own letter to the Speaker in the House and says that no inability exists. He, the President, shall resume the powers and duties of the office unless the Vice President and a majority of the Cabinet within 4 days transmit their written declaration that they really meant what they said the first time. And at this point, the Congress has to decide the issue within 21 days after assembling by two-thirds vote of each House, the same supermajority that's required to overturn a veto or to convict an impeached president that the president is unable to discharge. And in which case the vice president is back as acting president and Trump is banished for good. Well, let me tell you about the 25th Amendment a little bit, because it's an interesting history. It was proposed in 1965 after the assassination of President Kennedy. At that time, there was no provision to replace the vice president. So when Kennedy was killed in 63, Johnson, who had barely survived a heart attack in 1955, became the president. And behind him in succession was the Speaker of the House, John McCormick, who was a frail 71-year-old. And next in line was the President Pro Tem, Carl Hayden, 88 years old and even more frail. So Senators Birch Bayh and Representative Emanuel Seller worked together to draft a constitutional amendment to establish a process for selecting a vice president. That became Section 2 of the amendment. And it says, whenever there's a vacancy in the office of vice president, the president shall nominate the vice president, who shall take office upon confirmation by a majority vote of both houses. But the drafters realized there was a second issue. What if JFK had survived but was in a coma? Or what if LBJ had a second heart attack that left him comatose? Or what if the president suffered a severe stroke like Woodrow Wilson did in 1919? Leaving the de facto presidency to his wife, and what, even more problematic, if a president declared that he or she had recovered, but others in the administration thought otherwise. That is what Section 4 deals with. That's the one that the liberals are salivating over. But in the 50-year history, Section 4 of the amendment has never been invoked when the president himself was non-compos. Interestingly, in 1982, when Ronald Reagan was wounded by an attempted assassin and under surgery, Vice President Bush did not invoke Section 4 because he was on a plane returning from Texas, and Reagan got out of surgery by the time Bush arrived back in Washington. Later, Senator Birch Bayh, the author of the amendment in the Senate, wrote that Section 4 should have been invoked. Anyway, for the moment, any activation of the 25th Amendment remains a fantasy. Of course, so did the election of Donald Trump. And the collusion of the Trump White House with the Russians remains a hanging issue. Now, I think we can discuss, when we get into the questions, how much of a hanging issue it really is. But anyway, I think it's a fascinating scenario to entertain. Anyway, that's my presentation.
Thank you, Bill. You have submitted some excellent questions. We'll get to them in just a few minutes. But first, I wanted to give the speakers an opportunity to address questions to each other.
Guy, do you think the President of the United States is separated from reality?
I think the President of the United States I want to answer this carefully. I think the President of the United States has lived his entire life surrounded by people who tell him how great he is. And he is, like many politicians, but more so than most, addicted to affirmation. And so I think he is willing to sort of casually put out information that he knows is questionable, at least on some level, if not false, just to help construct narratives or talking points that in some way benefit him and soothe his ego. That's what I'll say.
Let me ask Joe a question. Joe.
Sir.
Do you think that the fact that Trump campaign, at the time of the Republican convention, deleted the plank in the Republican platform to that favored the transmission of lethal assistance to the Ukrainian government, was a smoking gun with respect to any sort of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia.
There is so, I agree with Guy, that we haven't proven collusion. But there is so much smoke here. And that particular episode is one of the smokiest. You know, it takes a as anybody who's a lawyer, or for that matter, a former congressional investigator knows, you really have to have a lot of evidence to prove something like this. And we just don't have it yet. It's circumstantial. It's confusing. There's denials and then denials of the denials in this particular thing. You all understand what happened here, right? The Republican Party has long favored a tough line on Russia. So it's no surprise that in the draft part of the party platform, there was a provision to provide lethal arms to the Russian rebels. It's been one of the key Republican...
Ukrainian rebels. Ukrainian government.
No.
Yeah.
Yes, the Ukrainian government.
Yeah.
Sorry. Got it. Thank you. And so and this had been one of the attacks on the Obama administration, that we weren't willing to do this. The Obama administration felt, you give them heavy arms, heavy lethal arms, you're just going to fuel the conflict. This was seen as weakness. So there was a provision in there, and it got removed. And the Trump administration campaigns, we had nothing to do with that. Well, in fact, that is exactly what people on the platform committee said happened. No, people from the Trump campaign came and told us to remove this. And so there is, and you probably have a lot more information on this than I do, but there's intense controversy about this. And then the collusion part comes in the conversations that Trump campaign officials allegedly had with Russian diplomats, Russian officials, about this provision. And the allegation is that the campaign officials were promising Russia that if they were elected, they would remove the sanctions on Ukraine and would take a much softer line on support for the Ukrainian government. Wait, a softer line that they wouldn't be backing the Ukrainian government in their conflict with Russia. It gets more complicated because of Rex Tillerson. And again, this is just smoke. But Rex Tillerson has worked for ExxonMobil his entire adult life. This was his only job. I think it's 35 years. One of the biggest deals he ever conducted while he was there was his deal with Russia to allow ExxonMobil to come in and exploit, that is, drill for natural gas and oil in this vast swath of Russian territory. It dwarfed all the other deals that he had made for ExxonMobil. This is a deal that's potentially worth $500 billion. $500 billion. That's more than most countries make in their GDP. The problem is Russia invaded Ukraine or assisted in the disruptions in Ukraine, and the U.S. and Western Europe slapped sanctions on Russia that prohibited precisely this kind of cooperation with Russia. Blocked ExxonMobil from fulfilling the terms of this. Now Rex Tillerson is Secretary of State. Huh. Do I want to go so far as to say Rex Tillerson's number one job as Secretary of State is to remove Ukrainian sanctions to allow ExxonMobil to make $500 billion over the course of his life, over the course of the contract, and that therefore vastly increase his own personal wealth? I do not know that. I cannot say that. But this is part of the smoke that is swirling around. It's not just the political collusion. It's the economic interests that are deeply ingrained with some of the members of the Trump cabinet and Russia. Got it.
So a few things. I'm very excited to see Democrats suddenly being Russia hawks. This is a good development, I think, over the last few months.
We have to talk more about that. About the negative effect this has happened in the Democratic Party, how they're just bashing Russia.
So I remember, I'm so old that I remember when President Obama knew about the Russian attempted interference in the 2016 election during the election and declined to come out more publicly about it because he didn't want to ruffle the Russians, because the Russians have been partners with him on a few important things, including the Iran nuclear deal. So everyone assumed, including the Russians, including Obama, Hillary's going to win.
Yeah.
It's not worth blowing this up more, because that's going to end up pissing off Moscow, and we wouldn't want to do that. So I guess my question for you guys, and this is a fun question to ask. In the 2012 election, I remember Governor Romney saying that Russia was their top geopolitical adversary. And I remember President Obama saying the 80s called, they want their foreign policy back. And everyone had a good chuckle at the expense of Governor Romney. Attaboy, President Obama, you showed him. Wasn't Governor Romney right?
Governor Romney was probably right. I think that's true. Bill Maher tells this great joke a couple of weeks ago. He says, I gave $1 million to Obama to defeat Mitt Romney. I would give Mitt Romney $1 million if he would just come back.
Yeah, Mitt's really hurting for cash.
Before we go to questions, let me just say one thing about it, slight counterpoint, and that is, it seems that that Putin is testing Trump right now. If there's collusion, they're making a pretty good act about trying to cover it up, because Putin is pushing hard. He's pushing hard in Ukraine. They've started tremendous escalation of hostilities there. They've just announced that they will accept the passports of these separatist provinces in the Ukraine. And one of these provinces, Luhansk, one of the two provinces, has just announced that the ruble, the Russian ruble, is going to be the official currency in Ukraine. And there's absolutely no sign that Crimea, which of course has been annexed by Russia, is going to be, you know, anytime. That's sort of like the Jerusalem issue for Russia. That's not going anywhere. And the Russians are also moving elsewhere. They're moving, as Joe said, in France. Not only did Marine Le Pen go to Moscow, but the Russian, she gets money from the Russians. Russian banks are funding her campaign, and all over Europe, the Russians are moving in a way that is adversarial to the Western alliance structure of NATO and the EU. Russians were pro Brexit. That is a terrible dilemma that has happened to the UK, where they voted to leave the EU. The Russians are overjoyed by that. So they're moving in Libya. They're moving in Syria. It's not an open and shut case here of collusion. And at some point, Trump is going to have to decide whether he's really colluding or whether he's not. Anyway.
Any further questions from the panel to the panel? For now. Okay, let's go to your questions. One student question was, at what point does the smoke become enough evidence to prove collusion?
You have to have transcripts of conversations. That would do it. What did Paul Manafort actually say in these conversations? Transfer of funds would be strong evidence. a Russian coming over and turning on this? Michael Flynn. You know, very interesting. He has a story to tell that nobody's bought that yet. But he was in the thick of this, that kind of a testimony. That's the kind of thing you would need to make the case.
Yeah, hard evidence, right?
Hard evidence.
Something beyond the passage from CNN that I read, right? And again, if I think that it is pretty clear that a lot of the leaks to the Post, to the Times, and elsewhere, they make Trump look bad. And it sort of adds to this atmosphere of, you know, smoke billowing on this. But if you take it a step back, someone unmasked the identities of Americans in these conversations, which, by the way, allegedly were not about Russia, but in conversations that were picked up by the NSA while monitoring phone conversations involving foreign officials and operatives. Incidental collection is what it's called. It's not unusual. Unmasking the identities of the Americans on that phone call is less normal, less accepted. And the question is, if these conversations had nothing to do with Russia, what was the reason to unmask them? And if they did have something to do with Russia, what were they saying? And I think with the drumbeat of leaks that we've seen from people, clearly have seen the transcripts. They've been floating out there for a while. If that type of hard evidence existed already, I think we would know about it. So, again, I'm not saying Comey's not done with this yet, right? There are still people who might come out and testify and say extremely damaging things. I just think we're getting way ahead of ourselves. You know, reading columnists saying, well, gosh, well, can Trump survive his first term? These are the same people saying Trump could never win the nomination. Trump could never be elected president. And they've been saying he could never do X, Y, and Z for 2 years, and he keeps doing these things. So, I mean, I think how many times we're going to step on the rake and claim, you know, this is really going to be the thing that finally takes him down. It might be, it might not be, but I think jumping to that conclusion, we're making ourselves look silly over and over again.
There's a lot of reasons why Donald Trump...
speak closer to the mic.
There's a lot of reasons why...
Your mic off.
Thank you very much. There are a lot of reasons what happened.
There are... 1, 2, 3? I don't know. There we go. There's a lot of reasons why people are opposed to Donald Trump and why they're deeply troubled by his policies, his behavior, his gross conflict of interest. And so Russia is just one of them. It's just that Russia strikes at such a core national security interest of the United States that there's this much interest in it. I just got to answer this masking thing. You know what we're talking about? So the intelligence services monitor foreign diplomats all the time. So we are monitoring what Ambassador Kislyak is saying in his phone calls. Why Michael Flynn didn't know this is very strange, very strange. So when Michael Flynn has a phone call with the Ambassador Kislyak, the intelligence services are listening and they hear Kislyak talking to Michael Flynn. Okay, so we do this routinely. And these talks are transcribed, and sometimes Americans' names come up in a discussion, say between Russians, and they're talking about, you know, I think we have a lot of influence in blank's presidential campaign. That name of that American is covered up when these agencies transmit this transcript to the other agencies and to the White House, et cetera, or the intelligence agencies. So you can request that this name be uncovered, as they say, unmasked. But Susan Rice doesn't have the authority to do that. The intelligence agencies have to agree that there is a national security interest in revealing that name. And so, for example, if you saw that Russians were talking about how they were going to influence so-and-so's campaign, that is a pretty compelling national security interest to say who is that American they're talking about. And that you would then want other people in the intelligence agencies to know that there's an actual Russian effort to influence this person. That is something you would want to know. Does that get spread around? Is that normal? It's normal. Unmasking happens all the time. There is nothing unusual about that. What's unusual is finding conversations about Russians talking about how they're going to influence so-and-so's presidential campaign.
Yeah, no, and the thing is, Rice in her capacity as National Security Advisor, could make these requests.
Requests.
And then the IC had to agree to it.
Yes.
Now, there are also people within the IC, NSA in particular, alumni of the NSA during the Obama years, who said that often they would try to say no to Ms. Rice on a number of fronts, and they would eventually get steamrolled by the president, by the administration. So, again, I don't think it's an open and shut case in either direction. I'm not, you know, President Trump said,
yeah, so
you know, maybe... Maybe she committed a crime.
A crime?
Well, if she leaked national security information, that would be a crime, right? Maybe she did. But we don't know that, and there's no evidence to support that. So I think that's not the type of thing a president should be using about.
I will agree with you that we should take a look into this. But are these things equal in any way? No, not at all. Not at all.
Hang on. I think they are both serious, and here's why. I think Russia trying to influence our election speaks for itself why it's so serious. But if you had an outgoing administration improperly in some way monitoring or pushing out information about an incoming administration to try to undermine that administration using national security intercepts, like that is an alarming thing as well. Like, I don't think that that's a non-story, a non-issue. Of course, it's an issue.
Where's the evidence that they were monitoring?
Through the unmasking. We already know this.
That's not monitoring. I'm gonna bug your office. I'm gonna penetrate your laptop.
Right. They were monitoring foreign diplomats.
Yes, that's what they're monitoring. Not Trump or campaign.
Hang on though. Yo. Some of the Trump transition officials were on the phone with, for example, the Russian ambassador. So that U.S. official, because the target of that monitoring was the Russian and not the American, whether it's Flynn or whomever, their name, as you say, is blacked out.
But you said
if the president
is monitoring the incoming administration, that is not what they were doing.
But here's the thing, though. If they are requesting the unmasking of Trump officials without national security justification, I think that is concerning. And what we've heard from a number of officials, and part of the problem here is the just raft of unnamed sources on all sides of this saying self-serving things, but some U.S. officials who said they looked at the documents that Nunes saw and now Schiff has seen and clammed up about, they were saying the content of those conversations that were unmasked and then leaked around had nothing to do with Russia, had to do with internal domestic politics. That would be highly improper. So that's why I think this is a worthwhile investigation to pursue as well.
Question from the audience. You know, there are always leaks. They are more important now because the administration is not transparent. How can Americans find out what is going on without leaks to journalists?
Oversight. So, first of all,
traditionally,
as a journalist, I don't believe that journalists should be punished for receiving leaks. I think that there's a tradition of whistleblowing that is something that all journalists ought to defend. Now, there are people who swear oaths in public office not to disseminate classified information to people who shouldn't see that classified information. If we just throw that completely out the window, pretend that that's not a crime, there are such things as state secrets, and they need to exist for the security of the country. So there's a balance there. Congressional oversight, I think robust congressional oversight is something that's an important ingredient in all of this, which is why I was heartened by seeing, was it a week or two ago, the joint press conference from Senators Burr and Warner of North Carolina and Virginia, respectively, who got up there like grown men and actually gave information to the public and put on a bipartisan face and actually informed us of facts, as opposed to the slinging of crap down on the House side.
I'll be real quick, then you can go.
Okay.
There really is only one way, and that is what John McCain says we need, a bipartisan select committee. You have got to move it out of Congress, out of the political realm, just like we did with 9/11, and put together a group of people that you trust to dig into this and don't have a political off button.
Okay, I just want to defend the leaker. The leakers, because I agree that there are national security secrets that should not be leaking. If they are, they should be, the people who leak them should be prosecuted and to the full extent of the law. However, There's a lot of classified information that it shouldn't be classified and needs to be publicized. And needs to be, and in fact, there's a lot of information that that government officials want to get out to the public. And leaking is, for better or worse, one of the sort of ways that happens. And I think on balance, it is a positive, pro-democratic, pro-disclosure, pro-enlightenment phenomenon.
Can I make one more point? Because I think that this is, some of these cut in both directions. So on one hand, you had the documents that Nunes saw that, you know, everyone was very upset, and I think the way he handled that was really bad. Now he's recused himself. Adam Schiff, his counterpart from California, the Democrat, went in and looked at those exact same documents, and he came out and, interestingly, did not have one word to say about the content of those documents, but instead was still complaining about the process of how Nunes handled himself. To me, I thought that was telling. On the other hand, the President of the United States, regardless of who it is, has a lot of authority to declassify stuff. And so if there is classified information that would suggest impropriety on the part of the previous administration or whomever, the President can declassify it and let us see it. And if it's not vital to national security interests, I think it's reasonable maybe to urge President Trump to do exactly that. Let's see this stuff instead of reading about it fourth hand from unnamed sources with 18,000 caveats. Let's look at it.
Question. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Question for Guy. You stated that the reason President Obama did not want to release information about Russia's interference in the U.S. election was because he didn't want to upset Russia. Other media outlets indicated Obama did not want to give the appearance of attempting to influence the election. Where did you get your facts?
Well, a lot of people reported that there was a combination of facts, combination of reasons why the Obama administration didn't want to turn up the volume on this necessarily, one of which absolutely was what you just indicated, although, again, the argument that President Obama was trying to help Hillary Clinton win the election, it was, you know, this is not a secret. He spoke at her convention and said, please vote for Hillary Clinton and don't vote for that other clown over there. Like, he was, they could not, Democrats wanted a Democrat elected. So I don't think that there's much mystery there. And we've seen over and over again that the administration, the Obama administration, didn't want to step on Russia's toes because they viewed them as a crucial ally in some of these other fights at the UN and elsewhere on international deals like Iran.
I just don't think the evidence supports that. For example, we slapped on harsh sanctions on Russia after their invasion of Ukraine, even while we were cooperating with them on the Iran deal. And in fact, that cooperation continued while we were going hammer and tong against each other over Ukraine. I just don't think that. I understand why you make the argument. I just don't think there's any evidence to support it.
All right. I think that you could also have a debate about how intense those sanctions were right after Crimea and the administration declining to, for example, provide lethal aid to the legitimate Ukrainian government in Kiev with their sovereign territory having been effectively invaded by Russia. So it is interesting that there was so much criticism of the Obama administration from the right saying they were soft on Russia, and then we nominated and elected a man who was overtly soft on Russia, who said he wanted to be soft on Russia. There's a lot of things about the election that were puzzling to me.
Another student question. Why should the American public, especially the left with a history of distrusting the CIA and NSA, trust reports by the intelligence community regarding Russian interference and or collusion? Could it be another WMD in Iraq type report?
Can I speak to that? Because there's a very interesting thing that's just come up in the news in the last couple of days, which I think is a telling thing. This report that came from an anonymous administration intelligence source that the Russians were complicit in the chemical bombing in Syria, I think is a great example of it smells to me like propaganda, U.S. propaganda. because why would the Russians want to do this? An anonymous source. So I think the questioner is quite right. We should be very skeptical about intelligence leaks on both sides of this question.
There have been...
I'm sorry.
Real quick. Look, you have to investigate all your facts. And saying, why would you do this? It's not, you know, why would Russia do this? Just because something is stupid doesn't mean presidents won't do it. They do it all the time. And the CIA, and today, you can go, New York Times is on their website, they have the 4-page declassified intelligence of why they think Russia was complicit. Go read it. I mean, they say that there were Russian officials associated with chemical weapons program at the airfield in the day before the attack. Okay, let's go investigate that. Just because the CIA says it, I agree, whoever says it, does that mean it's true? I happen to have a lot of respect for our intelligence agencies. I did a lot of investigation on WMD in Iraq. The intelligence agencies a lot were getting it right until they were interfered with by the Bush administration, until Dick Cheney started bringing them over to the, going over to Langley and said, no, I'm not, that's not right, that's not right, that's not right. Until there was political manipulation of the intelligence, that's when you started to see the intelligence shift. They wrote a whole report about this. So just because the intelligence agency says it, does that mean it's right or wrong? No. Go look at the facts. Go have other investigations. Go ask them to prove it. Show your work.
And I would also say it's not just some random unattributed source from the IC making this claim about the Russians in the 2016 election. It is the consensus of all of the agencies, and Republicans and Democrats on these committees have seen the intelligence in closed session because it's sensitive stuff, and they all come out and say the same thing, which is, yes, this happened. So I think that there's a broad, serious consensus that I find to be totally credible. And as for Putin and potential Russian involvement or complicity in the chemical weapons attack, in what way is that implausible? They have been propping up the Assad regime for years. They're allied together because of Russian interests, Russian bases, Russian access to the sea and to oil and that sort of thing. They have stood by Assad's side, occasionally acting as his de facto air force, in the course of a conflict that has seen the killing of 500,000 people. Yeah. Like, Putin has journalists killed. He has dissidents killed. The idea that this is somehow beyond Vladimir Putin, of course it's not. He's been showing his work for his entire time as a tyrant in office.
I should come on your show. We should talk about this.
That'd be great. Fair and balanced, Fox News.
Another question from the audience. Could you please put Russian influence in 2016 in comparison to U.S. influence over the last century?
Oh, right. See, we don't exactly have clean hands here. I mean, I feel like a little Donald Trump when he says this, you know. Well, you didn't think we didn't do things like this? We're not killers? We have overthrown governments around the world. I'm trying to think of a continent where we haven't overthrown a government. Antarctica. No government. Only because there isn't one.
Australia.
Australia. Continent?
Australia's a continent.
Australia's a continent. Yeah, that's right. That's right. We haven't Australia. Okay, that's two. No, so we do this. We manipulate elections all the time, and the CIA was famous for this, for manipulating. Yeah, we do it all the time. What's distinct about this is, as far as we know, this is the first time the Russians have done it to us.
But it's not going to be the last time, and so
it's not going to be the last. That's the importance.
And I think we ought to probably get used to it a little bit because. There's nothing that, you know, as long as the Internet is out there and as long as the Russians have an army of trolls and hackers, they're going to be able to do this. Now, we can put pressure on them to stop it, and we can retaliate, but it's a new day out there.
By the way, I think we stopped doing it. I can't remember the last government we overthrew. But I think we've, in the last 20, 30 years, I think we have stopped doing it.
Are we sure that the Russians haven't meddled in previous U.S. elections? I mean, I don't think that that's an established fact either.
Fair fact. Fair question.
I'd like to throw in one question before going back to there. Several from the audience on the question of what can citizens do if they're dissatisfied with what's been happening in this subject. The question I would ask before that, though, is what is the situation of the Republican Party in, I mean, it is, after all, the Congress which has the constitutional responsibility if there should be an issue with performance of the executive branch. It's the Congress that decides whether impeachment is appropriate, and then if there is an impeachment, whether the president is removed or not. What does this do to or for the Republicans?
I mean, it's such a hypothetical in terms of what might play out, right? I would say that in the event, okay, so let's play out one of these hypotheticals. Let's say clear evidence of collusion with Trump's knowledge comes to the fore. And, okay, now what? You've got a Republican-held Congress. Are they going to do anything about it? Now, I would argue that some of the people that probably many of you in this room really loathe their politics, especially on foreign policy, uber hawks in the Republican Party, it's not like John McCain or Lindsey Graham or Marco Rubio or a host of those folks have become any less hostile towards Russia with the election of Donald Trump. And if there's proof out there that Trump worked with Russia, I think you would see a significant, even if you want to believe that a lot of Republicans would be total hacks and wouldn't want to do anything just to protect the president, there would be a critical mass of Russia hawk Republicans who would team up with the Democrats to do something about it. I'm pretty confident that that would be the case, just looking at the dynamics on Capitol Hill.
I think that's true, and I think public polling supports that, that you ask people if there was collusion, should the president resign, and overwhelmingly the American public says yes. So you would see that, and that's the political calculation. Remember, it's the House that has to impeach.
Sure.
So you're going to get the House to do this. So that's the calculation for Republicans in the House. At what point does this advantage become an albatross? At what point am I willing to cut my ties with Trump in order to preserve my own seat? And that's the calculation that has to be made.
Exactly. And you've got a vice president that's very, very acceptable to conservatives. In fact,
Many would rather have him.
Right, exactly. And don't forget the 25th Amendment.
Oh, and so what you can do, people are doing it. I mean, this mass movement is unbelievable. Everybody I know is doing something, and I can't say that about any issue I've ever been involved with. These group of Democratic staffers, the Indivisible people, who put up a Google Doc about 4 months ago that had 3 million downloads, and now people started forming chapters. There were 6,000 indivisible chapters, two in every congressional district. These town halls over health care, that's people mobilizing, going, no, it's not George Soros's money. No, it's not some great conspiracy. These are people that are doing it themselves, that are pushing Republicans to not repeal their health care. And they just won one of the most astonishing grassroots victories I've ever seen in my life. And they're just getting started.
You know, yeah.
Exactly. And how low does Trump's ratings in the polls have to go before he becomes a liability? Yeah. It's already 37% and falling.
Look, I would say on what we're seeing in the organizing, I would, with respect, of course, it's a serious phenomenon, a widespread phenomenon. Whether or not there's been some outside funding or whatever, I don't view that as really relevant. Like, yes, the Koch brothers also helped with some organization with the Tea Party, but the fact is there were still lots and lots of real people, grassroots people, in the Tea Party. So this is sort of a, more so than Occupy, this strikes me as a facsimile of the Tea Party on the left, where it sprung up largely organically, where the organized left is saying, aha, here's an opportunity, and getting on board, where it's across the whole country with, you know, in every state and people forming chapters. It is, that does remind me, it's reminiscent of the Tea Party.
It is reminiscent. This is one of the bright lights for me, because even though I voted Democratic my whole life, I've never been a Democrat. And I think the Democratic Party is just freaking inept. And I think the DNC is inept. You know, so what I see this movement is not the Democratic Party leading this. No, it's this mass movement that is upsurging, that is pushing the party. And so in that sense, it's right. This is reminiscent. Where was Town Hall born? Out of the Tea Party movement?
Oh, no. Town Hall goes way back to the 90s, mid-90s, actually.
Way back to the 90s.
Yeah. Well, as far as the Internet goes, that's ancient history, right?
Well, there are a bunch of great questions that we did not get time to address. You have been a terrific audience. I hope you'll give a round of applause for a great panel.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you.